It's a pleasure to try and introduce the subject to you all, especially since David is not here. It takes a little bit of the pressure off, at least. To take a little more of the pressure off, what we decided to do was break up this first Blackboard lunch.
You know this is being recorded, right?
Yeah, I know. You really think he's going to listen to it? If he comes back and tells me about this, then we'll know. This is a subject which covers quite a lot of ground within its confines, and in particular, we have a great variety of participants coming from backgrounds which are and interests which are almost on the applied side, very material specific, let us say, rather more abstract and esoteric theorists on the other end, and to try and give you some flavor about the range of content. We thought we would divide this talk up into parts. So we're going to do it like this. I'm going to start and give you kind of a quick introduction, hopefully quick, to the basic concepts which underlie this program, in particular what a Mott insulator is and some of their basic properties. And then Jeroen will take over and try and represent to you at least a few of the important problems on the materials side. And then I'll come back and try and approach the subject from the other end and talk about the kind of fundamental. You could read that as abstract side of the workshop. Program, I'm told. So let me start with this. First of all, what is a Mott insulator? Mott insulator is one side of the coin reflecting two limits of the kind of electronic behavior of solids. One of the basic facts about the theory of solids, which is probably the main feature that makes it a tractable subject for those of us working in condensed matter physics, is that there is one small parameter in solids. Which is given to us by nature, which is the fact that the electron mass is a lot smaller than the mass of the nuclei in a solid. This allows us to use, as a first approximation at least, pretty much throughout the theory of solids, the Born-Oppenheimer approximation. Which is to say that the ions move a lot more slowly than electrons. So to a first approximation, we just treat them as static. Okay, and pretty much all attempts to study phenomena in solids start on this assumption. People doing what we call first principles electronic structure calculations will do exactly this. They'll fix the atoms in some position, calculate the properties of the electrons, and then adjust the positions of the atoms and repeat this procedure to learn, for instance, the structure of a material. For our purposes, we can imagine doing this and think about just varying the lattice spacing, the lattice constant, in some given crystal and asking what the electrons do. So there'll be sort of two ends to this axis. In reality, you can try and do this to a solid, and you'll only be able to achieve maybe at best 1% or so compression of a material. But of course, theoretically, we can think about it. So there are two ends to this curve. There's a dense limit out here where the lattice spacing is small. Electrons are moving around in the background of some periodic lattice of ions, positively charged ions. And the potentials of these ions kind of rather strongly overlap to form some periodic potential. It's a bad drawing. So the potential that electrons see in such a solid is very badly approximated by that of an individual atom. And so in this limit, electrons very strongly delocalize. And this is really the limit around which the very successful first theory of the electronic properties of solids was built, the band or block theory. Block theory of solids, which says that electrons basically reside in plane wave-like states in a crystal. I should move this line over a little bit. So the other side of the coin is when the, if you imagine spreading these atoms further and further apart, then the ionic potentials only weakly overlap. And the electrons can be thought of as being approximately in atomic states. Okay. So, you know, in practice, we can't really do this in any given solid, but it turns out that nature actually kind of does this for us in different types of materials. So what happens, for the most part, is that electrons residing in the lower angular momentum states, so L equals 0 or 1, atomic orbitals, S and P orbitals, are rather well delocalized. As we go up in angular momentum to the D and F atomic shells, the electrons become quite a bit more localized on the atoms. And the basic physical reason for this is that if you consider electronic states just at the same energy, okay, but at different angular momentum, those with more angular momentum will have more kinetic energy as a consequence. So to keep the same energy, they have to be more tightly bound. So they have more negative potential energy, and they're closer to the nucleus. So this is the reason why electrons in D and F orbitals in solids tend to be more tightly bound. And a basic physical fact is, since the Coulomb interaction increases at short distances, if you cram electrons closer together, the effects of interactions become stronger. Okay. In these kind of dense materials where the electronic states are strongly overlapping and this band block theory of solids applies, then there's a kind of basic prediction that comes out of this band theory. So it's based on the idea that you can think of electrons in single momentum states which have some energy. These are energy bands parameterized by some index n and momentum k. And it turns out, just by counting, that each band can hold 2 electrons per unit cell of a crystal. So a consequence of that is that in order to have an insulator, maybe I'll move this up. An insulator in the band picture corresponds to a situation with filled bands. And this means it must have an even number of electrons per unit cell. On the other hand, if we think about this dilute picture, what we really have is we start with atoms. Have some atoms here arranged in some kind of lattice. And whatever their charge state is, there'll be some certain number of electrons on there on each one. And the question of whether a material conducts or not has nothing to do with bands, but it's a question of whether I can take an electron out of one atom and move it over and add it to another one. But when these orbitals are very tightly filled, this adding an extra electron to this atom costs Coulomb energy, which usually we call U, and in the atomic limit, this is the largest energy scale in the problem, and so it becomes very difficult for electrons to move. And you basically get an insulator no matter what, whether the number of electrons per unit cell is even or odd. Electron number per. Okay. So such a situation, an insulator with an odd number of electrons per unit cell is what's called a mod insulator. It's named after Sir Neville Mott. Got the, I think, 1977 Nobel Prize, along with Anderson and Van Vleck. So Mott insulators are these types of materials that are insulating, but would not be predicted to be insulating by simple band or block theory. Okay. So an interesting feature about materials with an odd number of electrons per unit cell is that this, or if you want an odd number per orbital, is that whenever you have an odd number of electrons, you're guaranteed by Cramer's degeneracy, Cramer's theorem, to have at least a twofold degeneracy of those states. Okay. Those electrons are a spin 1/2 particle. So this is the title of our workshop was Moments and Multiplets in Mott Materials. This is the reason why Mott insulators have moments. So what about multiplets? Well, if you start thinking about solids from this kind of atomic point of view, it's actually a rarity that you find only this twofold degeneracy. Most of the time, if you think of electrons in a D or an F shell, you have a higher degeneracy. For instance, in a D level, the D level's in an atom, there are 5 of them, you put some number of electrons in there. Let's say, I don't know what example I like to do. For instance, manganese 2+, that has a 3d5 configuration, the common valence for manganese in many solids. That means you have to put 5 electrons in this shell. So there are clearly many, many ways to do that. And even taking into account interactions on the atom, there are a number of famous results for that that sort of semi-empirical results that go under the name of Hund's rules that describe the electronic state of an isolated atom. For instance, the first rule is that the electronic state should have the maximum total spin quantum number. So for 5 electrons, the best you can get is, in this case, 5/2. There's a secondary rule, which is not necessary here, which is that then they have the maximum total orbital angular momentum, and that applies in other situations. So this manganese 2+, we have a much larger spin degeneracy. Instead of 2 states, you have 2s+1, which is 6 states. Okay. You can have other situations, like, for instance, sticking with manganese 3+. If it were an isolated space, you have a D shell with 5 degenerate levels, you have 1 less electron. Now, the first Hund's rule would tell me I have spin 2 rather than spin 5/2, but clearly I have quite a bit of choice in where I can put the orbital degrees of freedom. So there we have both spin plus orbital. In fact, in solids, you don't have spherical symmetry. probably the best you could have is cubic. For instance, a common situation is a octahedral environment, so that manganese is sitting, let's say, at the center of an octahedral, octahedra of some other atom, maybe oxygen. In that situation, symmetry actually splits these levels into a doublet. You'll probably see this in the next talk, next part of the talk, called EG and T2G orbitals. So these are basically the kind of diagonal, they have the symmetry of diagonal combinations of X, Y, and Z. And these are things like X, Z, Y, Z, X, Y. So in reality, manganese 3 plus in such an environment, if you start thinking about it, well, you would fill the lowest energy levels first, then put another spin up here, and you'd find, in addition to the spin degeneracy, a twofold orbital degeneracy. So this is actually quite common situation. This is what happens in a rather famous set of materials called the colossal magnetoresistant manganite compounds. And maybe you'll hear something about that.
So splitting is typically small compared to the U.
U is usually the largest energy scale. The splittings can vary from vary quite considerably from different parts of the periodic table to another. Another energy I didn't mention, which would come into play here for an ion in free space, would be spin orbit coupling. And the relative size of these splittings compared to spin orbit splitting. So this doesn't involve spin orbit. This is just due to the potential of an atom. This could be either large or small compared to spin orbit. Basically, the rule is the deeper you go in the periodic table, the more important relativistic effects become, and the spin orbit becomes larger compared to this. But U is almost always the largest scale. At least that's when we're in a way that defines what we mean by a mod insulator. So the upshot of all this is that it's actually very uncommon. To have a mod insulator without orbital degeneracy. There's a huge variety of DNF electron transition metal or rare earth metal materials that are mod insulators with all kinds of interesting properties. You'll hear about some of them in a few minutes, but much more often than not, one needs to think about this orbital physics.
So, it would be true for organics, right? I mean, organics are usually no orbital difference.
Yeah, so... basically the way in which one can remove orbital degeneracy is when you have very low symmetry environments. Okay. So before I pass it over, having taken way too much time probably, I just want to say a couple general words about some of the consequences, and then we'll start talking about specific materials.
Yeah, can I just ask, for when you say insulator,
yep,
you really mean, what do you really, is that just a conductivity limit?
So what I mean by insulator really is that, at the strict theorist definition, which is usually what I mean, is that the limit as temperature goes to zero of the conductivity is zero. Okay.
So something that has an Arrhenius-like tunneling, you would not call an insulator.
Arrhenius, usually I would call an insulator. Yeah.
You would.
Yeah, because the conductivity gets exponentially small at zero temperature.
At zero temperature, yeah.
Yeah, okay. That's true for most insulators. There can be some conductivity, but it's often very hard to measure if it's a good insulator.
So do these show Arrhenius-like laws?
Yeah, usually, yeah.
And that's how you measure the U?
No. No. So you, I mean, if you can measure it at all, it means it's not a great insulator. The best insulator. if it's a really good insulator, it's such a good insulator, it's very hard to measure that reliably. So you would try and measure.
You measure it that way.
Yeah. So you could measure it spectroscopically. So the meaning of U here, you can see from this atomic picture, is that of an energy gap. It's an energy cost. So you can try and actually, you know, excite that transition. By electromagnetic means or otherwise. So more often than not, that would be a way in which you measure an energy gap. So a better definition is probably something with a gap to excitations that carry non-zero charge or single electron excitations. Conductivity is a little bit of a dicey thing because it's highly dependent on impurities and things like that to use as an experimental probe. So just say a few words about consequences. So the upshot of all this is that most mod insulators, are, by definition, they have a lot of nearly degenerate levels. And degeneracy in quantum mechanics is a very fragile thing. It tends to get broken. It tends to get split. It can get split by lots of different things. And this leads to a lot of the interesting phenomena in mod insulators. One of the more famous ways in which it's split is something called the Jahn-Teller effect. That's Edward Teller, infamous Teller. This actually, I think, was dubbed a theorem in some 1937 paper where they're actually thinking about chemistry rather than solid-state physics. The basic physics of the Jahn-Teller effect is that this degeneracy you can see here is very dependent on symmetry. And with spherical symmetry, you have 5 degenerate states. With cubic symmetry, you can have 2 or 3 degenerate states. With a low enough symmetry environment, as Antoine pointed out, you can split the degeneracy completely. So the lattice can distort to split the degeneracy. And what Jahn and Teller argued is that if the atoms are really sufficiently isolated from one another, the lattice will definitely do that at low enough temperature. So the idea is, if you imagine a distortion, very simple argument, whose amplitude is proportional to some displacement u, so you move atoms by some amount proportional to u, such that that displacement breaks this degeneracy. Let's think, for instance, of twofold degenerate level. Then these levels will split by an amount, which is some constant times u. We had one electron in there. It will get lowered by some amount. It's small u, not big u. I can see Matthew's upset by my choice of terminology over there. Luckily, you can always hear him. So if you think of the energy cost for doing this, you will have lowered the electronic energy by an amount linear in U. It doesn't depend what the sign is, because if you change the sign, then the other state goes down. But there'll be an elastic energy cost, which is proportional to U squared. So because the energy lowering is proportional to U, it'll always be beneficial to do this. And you get some energy gain, which will be proportional to lambda squared. So that if you want the potential energy, it looks something like this, and there'll be some states down there which are lower in energy. So this is called the Jahn-Teller effect. And this is really strictly true only when we think about isolated atoms. If the electrons can either move or interact between atoms, then the degeneracy can be split in other ways. If they move around enough, you can get a metal. There could be all kinds of orbital effects, orbital ordering or magnetism, or more exotic possibilities. Those are probably the main physical consequences of orbital multiplets in mod insulators.
Does one call it Jahn-Teller only when it happens at low temperatures?
Usually, yeah, so it's a bit of nomenclature. You know, you could have a material which is, you know, which remains in a low symmetry structure until it vaporizes. Okay. And then you don't call it Yontiller anymore. It's the murky ground, so, yeah. Well,
as long as it does, it's below its melting
point. These things are not hard and fast, so it's, you know, you would want to call it Yontiller if the, you know, the energetic reason for it happening can be demonstrably shown to be this kind of splitting of degenerate levels. But there could be other reasons why such a structural transition could occur. So, I just, let me finish by just saying what makes this area kind of challenging. One of the challenges is just that orbitals are very directional. If you, you know, think of these orbital shapes I've drawn here, these d orbitals, the f's are even worse. They are very specifically have high amplitude in some directions of the lattice and not in others. So this thinking about models of orbital physics requires you to think about rather low symmetry problems. Probably the most important reason is that mod insulators, unlike simple solids, really have, I started writing multiplet, very distinct multiple energy scales. So in a mod insulator, there's some energy U describing the energy to add or remove electrons from atoms. And below that energy scale, the system is mostly exploring phase space involving these degenerate multiplets. However, there are then lower energy scales, maybe the energy change from one of these Yontiller distortions or some energy involving electrons hopping between orbitals or interacting between different orbitals. And only below this energy scale does other physics set in. And this can be much, much smaller than U. And often we're interested in temperatures that are even smaller or lower than that. Unlike in a simpler solid with mostly S and P electrons where all energy scales are kind of comparable, here there's kind of a hierarchy of scales we have to deal with before we get down to where you observe physics. So this is really kind of the fundamental problem of dealing with it.
There can be more.
There can be even more, yeah. So I'm simplifying here. There can be many more, yeah. All right, sorry I took quite a bit too long, but let's see. You should put this on.
I'll try to finish before David gets
it. Good.
Okay. I'll just add one thing on the orbitals. I tried to draw one. So, maybe that helps. So a d orbital, for instance, there's the 3z square minus r square, or this guy, would look like. So that's the electronic density distribution, would look something like this, right? Where, for instance, here the could be an oxygen, and here an oxygen. This is the octahedron that Leon was talking about. Another orbital could be its friend, could be, it's a bit probably more difficult to draw. And trying to do it three-dimensional. So that's another one. That's x squared minus y squared. And like Leon was saying, if you have ordering, for instance, of this orbital in this direction, then, for instance, you compress the system here, and that gives you an interaction between the orbitals on different sides. And normally, because this is so directional, these interactions are frustrated. But I will get back to that at the second part, where I talk about orbital degrees of freedom. First, I want to say something on multiferroics. And I must say, I mean, I chose these two topics. There are many other interesting things that will go on in the workshop. So by no means it's all that's being done, or by no means it's the most interesting thing. I will claim it's the most interesting thing, but at least something I can talk about. So multiferroics. Let's start first. What is a multiferroic? Well, it's rather simple. Multiferroic is a material that has both a magnetic polarization and the electric polarization. So magnetization. And polarization. P. What do I mean by with a polarization is it has a macroscopic dipole moment. So in a simple picture, a system with a dipole moment, for instance, plus charges here, think about the capacitor, and negative charges there, and this field is generated by, for instance, microscopic dipoles in the system that order. So ordering of microscopic dipole moments gives you a polarization. Is this enough to have a multiferroic? Well, it's not. Because what we want is a switching, to be able to switch the magnetization by influencing the polarization and the other way around. So I have to be able to switch P. Okay, P can be switched by M, the magnetization, for instance, by applying a magnetic field, external magnetic field, switching the magnetization, and therefore, because the coupling of the magnetization and the polarization, the multiferroic, also switching the polarization. And, or the other way around, M can be switched by P, which would do by electric field. Applying an electric field will change the magnetization of the system. Okay, so why would this be interesting? Well, I don't want to push applications too much, but you can think about it as, for sensor applications. Electric fields are easy to measure, magnetic fields harder. You can, so if you can have an intrinsic connection between both, might be good for a sensor. You can also think in terms of spintronics, which or the interface between electronics and spintronics. Normal electronics is working with charge, electron charge, but there's a field going out there that wants to do computations not with the charge of the spin, charge of the electron, but the spin of the electron. So if you want to interface those, you can think about a multiferroic as a natural setting to do that. These are just, okay, don't want to push that too much. Just to give you some examples, materials. For instance, terbium, MnO3, manganese oxide, or holmium, Mn2O5, or last one, nickel, 3-vanadium-2O8. Okay, so what are the questions about multiferroics? They have been studied for some time, but there's a new interest in them. The first question actually is, there are thousands of magnets, 10,000s of magnetic materials, and a couple of hundreds, if you look it up in the books, of ferroelectric materials, but there are only few multiferroics. And the question is just, why is that the case? That's a very fundamental question, and I think we have some understanding of it. On a qualitative level, on an empirical level, for instance, barium titanate is a good ferroelectric. At the same time, we know heuristically that this is because titanium actually is in a D0 configuration. There's 0 D electrons. And for ferroelectrics, it seems to be important that you have 0 D electrons in there to get a ferroelectric distortion. Well, for magnets, of course, you will need something in your D shell. You have some moment in your D shell here to get a macroscopic magnetic moment. So that's a kind of heuristic argument, but I think the details of that are.
Yep. Why does it help to have D0 to have a ferroelectric?
Nicola, you're there.
Two reasons. When your titanium tries to move towards its oxygen, if it has filled the electrons, then there's a larger Coulomb repulsion trying to pull it back. And it also it has less possibility to make an energy stabilizing covalent bond with oxygen because the oxygen's orbital is already filled, so it likes to bond with empty orbitals. So this is something actually the chemists call the second order ion Taylor effect. It's like the next determine the energy expansion as a function of distortion. The first, the linear term as a function of distortion gives you the Jahn-Teller effect that Leon described, and the quadratic term gives you these off-centric distortions for ferroelectricity. And these, it turns out that they're favorable, but they're negative with this balance of low Coulomb repulsion and high options for covalency. And that happens in D0 or P0 ions, like lead 2 plus, also rule off-center.
Yeah.
That's like a whole hour seminar
in itself. Yeah, okay. But I think, let's say, from a distance, you would say, okay, there's, of course, I mean, there are very fundamental, or the very chemical-like intuition isn't there, but to understand it from a fundamental level, we do not do that.
It's pretty fundamental. I mean, it's as fundamental as the regular Jahn-Teller effect.
No, okay, but I mean, the understanding of the effect, oh, okay, good. Obvious practical question, of course, if you look at applications, how can you construct a material that has largest multiphoricity? So large M and P, switchable with a low B or E field at high temperature. Okay, that's kind of interesting for applications. Then a bit more specific, so let's say number two, number three, about numbers. We know quite a lot about multiferroics, basically from considerations of symmetry. And actually, if you look at a multiferroic, you can see that it breaks two symmetries. Magnetization breaks time reversal symmetry. Why? Well, you can think of a magnetic moment coming from a current. If the current is going like this, you have a magnetic moment the other way, that way. Current the other way, you have a magnetic moment that direction. So time reversal is broken. And in a magnet, the polarization is spatial inversion. So a multiferroic is characterized by both time reversal and spatial inversion, symmetry breaking. Well, using that kind of arguments, you can construct effective theories, Landau theories, telling you when a system can be multiferroic and when not. So we have, say, effective theories, that's macroscopic, to describe it, which is go under the name of Landau, or Ginzburg-Landau. Which tell you essentially what can happen on the basis of symmetry. If you have a solid with a certain crystal symmetry, you can predict that it can be multiferroic, for instance, and a certain magnetic symmetry, you can predict that. However, to really understand something, of course, you need to get the numbers right, and that's something you cannot get from any from the symmetry considerations. So to get numbers, you will have to do a real calculation. And, for instance, the coupling constants, which are important, you cannot get from an effective theory. So there's a challenge out there, which partially can be addressed or is addressed right now with ab initio calculations, so electronic structure calculations, which Leon did not really talk about, but which are calculations that in some effective way take into account the Coulomb interactions, but just on a mean field, on an average way. So they can include some part of the Hubbert physics, but not all of it. On the other hand, you don't need to put anything. It's all ab initio. It's just Schrödinger equation that's being solved. What ab initio gives you for multiferroics is a polarization, and well, quite recently I compared numbers, and it's something that's really going on. But normally, or for all the cases I know, the polarization for ab initio is 2 to 3 orders of magnitude too large. And that, okay, that in itself is, of course, strange.
So in what sense is this predictive?
That's not true.
Well, I'll give you the example. No, I'm talking about multiferroics. So if I would talk about the ferroelectrics, that's the next sentence. In ferroelectrics, ab initio is spot on, basically. In multiferroics, we have holmium MnO3, we have holmium 2, holmium manganese O5. If you look at the papers, these predict orders of magnitude too large for multiferroics.
For those two systems,
and also there's a recent preprint for the hexagonal manganese that have spiral ordering. That just came out last week on the web. So, I'm just identifying.
The magnitude of others where it gets extremely correct.
I'm for the multiferroics. Which multiferroic?
Bismuth, ferrite,
yttrium, manganese. Okay, these are the, where the coupling is very small.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, right. Okay. But there was a question before.
Is there support here from the other? That's simply not true.
Well,
it's...
Maybe
a couple of incidences where it's not understood.
Well, I mean, what definitely is true that there's the spiral system. The hexagonal manganese, for these three, the numbers that Sylvia got last week.
How sure you are of the experiments that are being done on this?
Oh, I'm happy to get really some discussion in here.
And also, can't really do a realistic density functional calculation for an incommensurate spiral. So I don't know what was done here.
Okay. In fact, you're all proving the point that there's something interesting to be done, right? What is the experimental situation? Ask an experimentalist. So, I think that they're okay. At least these things are out there. Maybe they are not. You would argue that they're exceptions. Actually, I did not see, as you said, good calculations for spirals. So that's definitely something that one should work on. These are at least way too large. It can be indeed the experiment. It can be the theory. And actually, the most interesting situation would be, which is just a speculation, that okay, ab initio calculations do quite well for the ferroelectrics in the polarization, but maybe, possibly less for the multiferroics because of the correlations, which we know are very large in these systems, or can be very large in these systems. There's a large Hubbert hill.
Ab initio is that the experimentalist has discovered the material,
right,
with this chemical mixture and knows the crystal structure,
right,
and delivers that to somebody who then does the electronic calculation.
Correct.
Okay, is there any...
Do they know the symmetry braiding as well? I mean...
In many instances, they do. Sometimes you have to simulate that in the by your calculation. So, sometimes, yes.
It's a newish material.
So, normally, what's quite common is you know the, say, high temperature phase or crystal structure of the system, then below some temperature it goes ferroelectric, then you get small distortions in there, which are not always easy to measure. Which you could get, if you do an ab initio calculation, you could relax the structure and look how the system tends to distort.
Okay, so you allow, so ab initio here in this case is that you actually allow for the crystal structure to adjust.
If it's not adjusted yet, yeah.
You need to know which way it might adjust. That takes some guessing or input from experimentalists off.
Are you asking for the definition of ab initio?
I think I'm getting close. It's not predictive.
In principle, one could calculate the ground state crystal structure by trying all the possible ways.
Yeah.
But in practice, it's helpful if you have some indicators of this.
Well, as far as I know, there's no mathematical theorem actually that, for instance, a crystal will form that at the lowest energy state of if you just throw in titanium and oxygen, I'm not sure if you will get the cubic crystal in there. But so let's say one takes the crystal structure as a given.
Yeah.
like Leon said. What are spirals? Okay, spiral ordering. So you have a ferromagnet all spins up. Spiral spins are doing like this. Spiral ordering. So the actually interesting thing is that from this, from the symmetry is you see that if the spiral is doing like this, it has a direction. So it breaks time and spatial inversion. So it's kind of obvious if you think about it that it will couple to a, it will can induce a ferroelectric moment because it also breaks a spatial inversion. Okay. Okay, open problem. Then something other people are working on actually is the relation to orbital order and charge ordering. It's obvious if the electrons want to do form some crystal in themselves, so independent of the say real crystal structure, you can induce again a ferroelectric moment. So these are just the electrons that order. How this is related, whether this happens, and how is it related with real multiferricity, actually not very well known. There's, I would say. So that's the fourth thing. Shall I do quickly something about orbitals? Okay. I'll just do two things or three things that are interesting about the orbitals. Okay. Let's do number two on there, which is, what is the role of orbitals? At metal insulator phase transitions. And my basic point actually is that not much known there. Metal insulator transitions, so when you would take a MOT material or insulating material and you would make it more dense, like Leo said, you would get a crossover from the insulator to the metal at some point. How to do that in practice is, of course, a more difficult question. But the question what the orbitals do there is actually quite interesting and little researched. If you do a simple treatment which will be orbital degenerate Hubbard model, but forget about it, gives you enhanced metallicity. And you can give a very hand-waving argument why that is the case. Well, if electrons are, for instance, in the hopping around and they meet each other at the same spin, yeah, they are blocked because of the Pauli principle. If electrons meet each other and want to be on the same orbital at the same atom, they have to have opposite spins. Yeah? So now if there are more orbitals available, these electrons can pass each other having a different orbital quantum number, but they are not blocked anymore. So there is somehow less Pauli blocking in the system. So if the bandwidth, if the Hubbard U, if everything else stays the same, but you allow for more orbitals, more degrees of freedom for the electrons, there will be, in principle, an enhanced tendency for metallicity.
What does that mean if the bandwidth is the same? Sorry, does it mean just in practice?
You have to rescale. Well, in practice, I don't know. I mean, in the Hubbard model, you will have to rescale in such a way. I mean, you will allow for more orbital degrees of freedom, but your bandwidth, your T's, have to change, of course. That's what I mean.
But when you make this statement, are you allowing for Coulomb repulsion between electrons with different orbitals?
Yeah, let's say Coulomb repulsion is the same for all electrons in all orbitals on the same side. Okay. And there's no Hund's rule coupling in this kind of statement. So I'm saying, okay, this is it's a sweeping statement for which I can give a let's say, a hand-waving argument, but probably everything depends on details. Well, you would say, on the other hand, you can make counter-arguments saying, well, what these orbitals do, actually, they give directionality in the system. Yeah, if electron is in an orbital pointing up, it wants to jump to a side above it. Yeah? And actually, if you have this orbital ordering, orbitals will be confined in a one-dimensional, or almost one-dimensional chain along which they travel. And we know that, let's say, orbitals, again, sweeping, hand-waving, say, reduction, tendency to reduce dimensionality, or effective dimensionality of the, let's say, electronic system. And we know that lower dimensional systems are more, well, have a stronger tendency to become insulators, because disorder is, they're more susceptible, for instance, to disorder. Okay, another, you could say, well, if orbitals disorder, for some reason, suppose I'm close to this metal insulator phase transition, and the orbitals disorder, they just orient in some random way, yeah, then this will again reduce the metallicity of the system. Yeah. Just like spins, if spins are disordered, close to metal insulator transition, I will have reduced dimensionality, reduced metallicity. Okay, so there are just a few hand-waving arguments, but I think no really firm statements. Even on the level of, let's say, very abstract models, like Hubbard models, nothing is proven there, which is not easy, but it's not there. Okay, let me just do another one. Well, let's do the 3 and 4 at the same time, which is orbital liquids. You can imagine that, okay, the orbitals can order, they can have long-range order, for instance, all the elongated orbitals. But like spins, orbitals are a quantum degree of freedom. So spins want to have a Heisenberg uncertainty relation. They will tend to disorder in themselves because they are quantum objects, and the orbital degree of freedom itself is also a quantum object. So you can think of these orbital degrees of freedom not being static in the system, but fluctuating in some quantum way. And because of the fluctuations, they gain some energy with respect to the just plainly long-range ordered, let's say, boring phase. These things are heavily debated. Do they exist? Well, there was a claim in lanthanum titanium 03, which is a D1 system, by the way, but it's heavily debated. I think that at the moment, the odds are against it. There's also iron, scandium sulfide, 2,4, it's a spinel, also debated. Galiulin, Leudel. So here I'm thinking about insulators that still have some interesting quantum mechanics going on the orbital level. Well, you can say, well, I want to be less ambitious. Instead of this having a liquid of orbitals, I want to have fluctuating orbitals in there. So like two orbital sides forming the fluctuating, they fluctuate together, yeah? like a singlet, a spin singlet, doesn't matter. So these orbitals lock in with each other, they are fluctuating, but they form a solid of this kind of fluctuating, say, dimers. That would be an idea. Well, does a thing like that exist? Well, there's the orbital partial state, for instance, claimed. Doesn't matter what it is, but it's claimed to be there, for instance, in yttrium, vanadium 03. Let me not write a comment.
So you mean orbitals in two different atoms?
Orbitals in two different atoms that fluctuate together. So what would you say in general about orbital liquids? Well, they in insulators, they might be there. No strong evidence in favor, I would say. Reason, well, orbitals talk to the lattice. And even if the orbitals are light degrees of freedom, the lattice is a heavy degree of freedom. Because of the Jan-Teller effect, the orbitals see the lattice, they have to distort the lattice if the coupling is large. And the lattice is basically a classical object, so if electrons, orbitals want to fluctuate, they have a hard time if the electron-lattice coupling is large. So you will have to look anyway at systems where the lattice coupling is smaller. Then in insulators, we don't know. In metals, we do know that orbital liquids exist, do exist. What do I mean with a metal here? I mean a MOT insulator. Do I have a picture of a MOT insulator? MOT insulator was a picture, for instance, like this, where these are the atoms, these are the spins of the electrons locked on it, and it cannot move because of this large Hubbard U, this large Coulomb interaction. Yeah, so this is an insulator. Now if you introduce holes here, for instance, remove this spin, then there is no reason for this electron not to move to its neighboring side. Yeah? So you can dope your system with holes, or for that matter, electrons, and you might get a metal. Well, experimentally, actually, it happens. You get metals in the manganites, for instance, lanthanum, strontium, MnO3, 1 minus X, X, where X is this, say, the number of holes that you introduce in the system. If you do not introduce any holes, this system has orbital ordering. If you introduce the holes, the electrons start hopping around. They hop from orbital to orbital on neighboring sides, and they mess up, as it were, the orbital background. This material is also colossal magnetoresistance material, but it doesn't matter. So what we want to do, of course, is understand the behavior of this doped MOT insulator. And it's relevant for this material, for many other materials, but it's an extremely hard question because it's related, for instance, to the question of high TC superconductivity, which is relevant for similar materials, for instance, lanthanum, strontium, 2 minus X, X, copper oxide, which looks very similar to this guy, but where I have orbital degrees of freedom here that order if I remove the strontium. If I remove the strontium here, it is the spin degrees of freedom that order. But spins and orbitals are not that much different. They're just some kind of orbital. They're just a degree of freedom belonging to the spins. So you could ask, well, if I can solve this guy, I can solve high TC superconductivity, so why not start with this guy first? But a reason is that it might be that actually orbital liquids are a bit different in some way from, let's say, spin liquids. Orbital liquids, for instance, you could think that they are much closer to a kind of degenerate. Well, let's not say that. But the difference is that here the spin is a conserved quantity. If the electron hops around, it conserves its spin. Where for orbitals, that's not necessarily so. An electron that's in this orbital can, for instance, hop to its neighboring side to again this orbital, but also to the planar orbital. So this orbital index changes while the electron is hopping around, and that's quite a bit different from the spin liquids. Leon, questions?
Just one comment. You know, if I took LaMnO3 and heated it up above its orbital ordering temperature, wouldn't you call it an orbital liquid?
So zero temperature, quantum.
I'm talking only quantum.
Yeah, I'm talking zero temperature quantum, orbital quantum, you're right. Absolutely.
Just 10 minutes, Marty, or you want to be interested? People can vote with their feet, but that'd be interesting. Maybe getting a wrap.
Okay.
Okay, so actually I think we're left at kind of a good stopping point for this. I wanted to just try and conclude by maybe summarizing at a kind of high level where some of the conceptual questions are and sort of broadest conceptual questions are and give you a flavor of that. So Jeroen talked about these orbital liquids, and I think what I have to say kind of relates to that rather clearly. So there's a basic physical problem that we have to face when talking about any mod insulator which has some degenerate multiplets, which is how do we describe the electron dynamics within the subspace of this degenerate multiplets? Part of the problem is even formulating that question: which orbital should we be dealing with? That may or may not be easy. Okay, let me consider that a materials issue and just think about sort of the rest of it, the theoretical problem. Okay, and that problem is quite vast, and really, I would say we only understand it well in one instance. So, dynamics. In multiplets. Okay, so this basically means that energy is much less than our Coulomb U. And the one instance when we understand it is is if the material orders. Okay. So very often, as Jeroen indicated, that's the case. That at least at zero temperature or low temperatures, let's say low T, T less than some critical temperature, the system selects somehow by Jahn-Teller, by interactions, what have you. It selects some unique set of orbitals, and when that happens, we know at least empirically that in the vast majority of cases, some kind of mean field theory is good enough for such a description, and that's what our most powerful computational approaches, for instance, ab initio calculations, always presume ultimately. This may or may not be the case. In many cases, we're interested in situations when we have T greater than of order TC, or maybe TC is even zero. In that case, we can't really restrict to some reduced set of local degrees of freedom, and we really need to understand, how to deal with this full problem, deal with electrons fluctuating or occupying many states, many local states. So that occurs in a number of situations that are interesting. One way that this happens, which seems to happen a lot in D and F electron materials, is that these materials can show what are called competing orders. several different ordered states appear. Unrelated ordered states. Can appear simultaneously. So a classic example where that's been studied heavily recently is in the high-TC superconductors, so-called under-doped materials. Experimentalists have found evidence for all kinds of different ordered states apart from the obvious superconductivity and antiferromagnetism, things called stripes, checkerboard, charge density waves, perhaps orbital currents, other kinds of magnetism. It's common in these bangunite materials that Hirun mentioned. One often sees spatial coexistence of ferromagnetism and charge ordering. It's very, very common in strongly correlated materials with DNF electrons that one finds experimentally and in calculations rather different ordered states that are quite close to one another, maybe proximate in the same sample or close in energy. And really, this is something we don't understand very much. You can ask the question, why does this happen? A more ambitious question is there some unifying principle? If it does happen, which we know happens a lot, how do we describe a system for which these very different ordered states are close by in energy? There have been a lot of interesting ideas ranging from simple things to rather exotic ones like quantum criticality that might have something to do with this. Do these things always compete in the... Or do different ordered states actually foster one another one way or another? That's certainly an issue in ITC. In other situations, you can have, as Jeroen was saying, situations with no order at all. Where rather than just a few different ordered states appearing simultaneously, one just sees the system that fluctuates. So this is kind of a heavily studied topic theoretically. To make it a little bit more concrete, let me give you a very simple example. Just spin liquids. There's a rather well-studied context, which many people in the workshop have worked on, which is that of frustrated magnets, particular frustrated antiferromagnets. So an antiferromagnet is something where spins on different atoms would like to anti-align. And if you have three spins interacting this way in a triangle, or third spin here doesn't know what to do, should it be up or down? An experimental signature of this is if you look at the susceptibility at high temperature, the magnetic susceptibility in a mod insulator generally has a Curie behavior at high T. It behaves like 1 over temperature. That's a signature of a free moment. In a ferromagnet, it would be a little bit larger than this and would tend to diverge at some temperature. That temperature is called the Curie-Weiss temperature. In an antiferromagnet, this Curie-Weiss temperature is usually negative. It's less than zero. And it gives kind of a measure of how strong the antiferromagnetic interactions are. So a signature of frustration is that when the system orders, its temperature that it orders at is actually much less than the absolute value of this Curie-Weiss temperature. That is, if you were to plot chi inverse versus temperature, it would be sort of extrapolating to zero temperature at some positive value here. So the intercept with the zero occurs at the negative axis. That's the Curie-Weiss temperature. But it only drops to zero at some, actually diverges at some critical temperature down here, where this is much smaller than the, this is minus the Curie-Weiss temperature. So this ratio here, empirically, called the frustration parameter, the ratio between the Curie-Weiss temperature and magnetic ordering temperature, And empirically, one, for a non-frustrated system, this is usually number of order 1. If this is bigger than maybe 5 to 10, we consider it highly frustrated. There's quite a lot of work studying such frustrated systems. When this happens, when F is big, then you have a regime of temperatures where temperature is less than this theory of ice temperature, but bigger than TC, where this means that the intrinsic magnetic interactions are strong, so the spins are quite strongly correlated, but it hasn't yet ordered. So we can't describe it by this simple kind of mean field paradigm, and yet we know there are strong spin correlations. So how do we describe this regime? That's a key problem. We have a little bit about it. There are certain classical examples that we understand. Tantalizing thing, which is what Jaren was talking about, is something called a quantum spin liquid, where TC just is actually zero, and you can take temperature all the way down. Probably the biggest subject of theoretical, conceptual theoretical work related to this workshop, but it's one in which we're both succeeding and failing quite dramatically. I kind of like to point this out. It's a situation that reminds me these days a little bit of string theory for those of you in the audience. So as of about 10 years ago, you would have been hard pressed probably to find a condensed matter theorist who believed a quantum spin liquid was possible in principle. Okay, there were a few, but most people would think it's not. Now that's changed dramatically, so we've made a lot of progress. Most theoretical condensed matter physicists probably believe it's definitely possible in principle because there are example models that do it. The problem is that we've learned through a lot of these theoretical advances that not only are they possible in principle, there are too many of them. So just like this should ring sound a little familiar to those people doing the landscape and string theory. For instance, there have been papers trying to classify them on just the simplest possible spin liquids on the square lattice, which find more than 200 possible states, distinguished in very minute ways. Okay, so theoretically we have too many. They're quite interesting. Experimentally, they're basically none. So that's what gives us a little hope in this program. It turns out that very recently, in the last couple of years, there have been some really exciting experimental developments as materials growers have improved a lot of these Mott materials and found a few examples of exactly this type of behavior where the susceptibility just heads right on down to zero temperature. A kind of particularly beautiful one.
Yeah.
The string tension was too large, I think. Actually, tomorrow's talk will be by an experimentalist who has been involved in measuring a very beautiful new material, which is something called Herbert Smithite, which is named after a British mineralogist named Herbert Smith. He didn't discover this, and it's a material which realizes this kind of beautiful structure of a Japanese fishing basket. It's called a kagame basket. So it's a kind of lattice composed, if you take a look at it, of a lot of corner-sharing triangles. Is it a juice too? Okay. why? All right. Okay. So there's a juice. So it has a Curie of ice temperature of about 300 Kelvin and doesn't order down to 60 millikelvin. So it's really pretty dramatic. There's another material called sodium iridate, which is similar, has a three-dimensional structure, Curie of ice temperature of about 600 Kelvin, doesn't order down to 2 or 3 Kelvin, lowest temperatures measured. There are a few other candidates. So these are somehow beginning to be visible in the experimental community. I should also say that these are probably only the tip of the iceberg in that experimentalists have had to actually work extremely hard to find these simple examples like this kagame material because they've been talking a lot to theorists who like to study models which don't have any orbital degeneracy. As a point I tried to make at the beginning of this talk is that the vast majority of Mott insulators do have orbital degeneracy, but theorists like to work with spin models. But in fact, that's a highly restrictive thing if you look in the space of mod insulating materials. The vast majority of them, of interesting mod insulators, do have orbital degeneracy, and we're really probably putting much too much of a restriction on it. Actually, I wanted.
Do you think orbital liquids are even less likely to be found or to be in principle there?
No, I don't. I don't think so. I don't think so. No, I don't think so. I think we just. I think theorists don't think about them enough. Right? So actually, I was going to point to the same example that Jeroen pointed out, this iron scandium 2S4, just to make that point and finish. So there's a, you can ask, you know, can we really get, can we increase quantum fluctuations and get to these interesting spin orbital liquids by going to orbitally degenerate materials? And there are indications that that may be the case. I'd like to point out, this is a you can draw a nice picture of a set of spinel materials, AB2X4. This is a kind of a particular class of cubic material where the A atom here, I'm going to consider ones where these are magnetic. I'll just try and draw a plot here of different materials that I know of that have been measured on this F-axis, and just put a point here on marking where these materials are. Quite a lot of them. Spinel is an extremely common structure, by the way. One of the jewels in the British crown is a spinel. They're pretty common. Cobalt, rhodium 204.
How many jewels are in the crown?
I can't tell you that. I don't know.
Since we gave up India.
So you probably don't care about these, but here's another one. So this is, I don't know, five materials here which have all been studied experimentally that all do not have orbital degeneracy. They all have orbital singlet states but different non-trivial spin multiplets. But in this family, only one has been studied seriously that has orbital degeneracy, which is this iron scandium 2S4. But if you put it on the same plot, this is up at F of around 900.
F is defined the same way in terms of the magnitude.
So, and I, at least in this family of materials, there's clear indication that allowing the system to fluctuate orbitally can lead to, you know, qualitatively different, interesting fluctuation regimes.
Orbital fluctuations might help spin liquids. Maybe orbital liquids themselves are.
Yeah, so lanthanum titanate, the claim was that the spin was not fluctuating, but only the orbital was. I mean, that's that story. I don't want to get into that story. But,
one problem with orbital liquids is the particles coupled to the lattice much more strongly than spins.
Sure. I think all these things are, you know, they are, you can try and make these general statements, but until we have, you know, more systematic search for them, we don't really know. But these are good subjects for the workshop. And, let me end. Thanks.
Thank you for the hour of